Hello and welcome to what is a Wednesday webcast. And today Scott isn't with me. Scott is still not on up to 100%, so he sends his apologies. But I'm with Mary Joy Johnson, who is a, well, I'm not going to even pretend to describe who you are or do an introduction. Hello, Mary Joy, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely pleasure. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself? And let's just start at the beginning. Who are you? Why are you? What are you doing here?
Yeah. So my name's Mary Joy Johnson, and I'm here because I'm an adoptive parent. And I've been an adopter now for around 13 years. And professionally, I'm a psychotherapist. And I specialise in working with all the different ways that trauma and stress can show up in our lives. And the reason that I trained in that is because that was my story, and it wasn't specifically only because of adoption that I found myself struggling, but just like that culmination of family life and then compounding factors, some pre-existing vulnerability, perhaps, that I hadn't really identified until I was put under extreme pressure. And then I found out, oh, look, I can't manage that. Didn't know that I couldn't manage that. And I didn't know that that's what I do when I can't manage things. And so as a result of that, really, before I trained in psychotherapy and then specifically in trauma therapy, I experienced it myself from the inside out.
Right. That's really honest. I mean, are we talking pre-adoption or post-adoption? Or
yeah, a little bit. So I have some trauma history, as many of us do. You know, we don't all come as blank slates. And lots of people are drawn into caring professions, caring roles, doing different things in their lives because they resonate with the needs of others and know what it's like to have been vulnerable and either to have been really well attended to and cared for. So, you know, feeling motivated to do the same, or perhaps not having been really well cared for or attended to and wanting to redress that in some way and be the change in some description. So I have birth children as well. I knew that Well, my mum said to me, you've always said you wanted to adopt, even from when you were a child. You said that you'd always wanted to adopt. So it was always something that I was, you know, interested and passionate about. I had my two birth children prior to adoption. But yeah, I had my own challenges. And so I hadn't realised that I was walking around with a vulnerability that was potentially going to go bang at some point. And again, you know, perhaps if circumstances had been different, maybe it wouldn't have happened. But in my case, and it was a sort of well-managed bang, but just I wasn't okay. And it wasn't specifically down to my experience as an adoptive parent, but just the compounding factors of stress and caring and managing, let's just say, sort of potentially more, wasn't so much behaviors in our case, it was just the special needs care. So, and just not getting enough sleep and advocating for education and advocating for health needs. And
all that extra and then realize, stuff.
Just for me in that case, it was all the extra stuff. And, you know, it's a bit like stress testing. Sometimes you just don't know what load you can bear until you suddenly realize you can't anymore.
That's interesting, because I was talking to someone earlier today about the fostering assessment, how we assess people to be foster carers. And she came from a therapeutic perspective as well. And her view was that actually we need a more, I'm trying to think, not scientific, but more a more psychotherapeutic perspective on that, or a component of psychotherapeutic assessment to really unpick adopters. And often I hear adopters saying, oh, they're kind of the digging around in stuff that's kind of, it's a done deal. So what's your perspective as a therapist and as someone who's been through the process?
Yeah, I just as a personal point, I would love every person coming in, foster or adopters, to be offered some therapeutic input. Not so much about kind of digging and trying to find out where the cracks are so much, because I think that could be enormously violating.
Yeah, and that was the point of the thing. No, enormously violating. Workers are not equipped for that, are they?
Yeah, and also it's actually quite easy to open people up, but then if you don't have the services to then and commitment to help put them back together again and to build the new version, you've got to be really careful. And there are many resiliency models. You know, you don't have to assess somebody to be looking for the cracks and to be looking for the fault lines. You could be looking for where is their resiliency, and to some degree, that does happen. It was certainly my experience when we were going through the adoption process. Of course, they were looking at our infrastructure and what supports do we have, and various things like that. But I think, and I don't know quite what it would look like, and yet you could do a bit of a screening for vulnerability. You can do quite basic psychological assessment that just sort of screens for trauma, screens for complexity and history without going into the details. And obviously knowing that the services are often very hard to come by, but if you could do that whilst identifying and what they might do about that and what service might meet that need should they reach that point as part of a kind of integrated assessment process that's setting people up to win and is identifying strengths, so a kind of a strengths-based identification, but then the safety net for if something sort of goes twang somewhere along the line. And I think to just have the understanding, to be trauma-informed, to recognize that we know there is a strong empirical evidence base for the fact that as human beings, we can all only tolerate so much exposure to prolonged stress before it starts to have implications. I mean, I keep using the word bang because that was my version. Well, some people, it's a very dull thud, or it's a numbing, or it's very quiet, and it's actually I've not got the capacity anymore, and I'm withdrawing or I'm isolating in some way. And to just have that awareness, and for people to have some psychological education, we call it psychoed, as part of the adoption process, how to self-assess, how to read the signs. Oh, I'm noticing I'm meeting some of my own thresholds.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And you know, it's like all things, early intervention. If we're meeting those physiological, they're not just emotional and psychological, they impact on the body. So if we start to meet some of those needs far sooner in the parent carer, in the kind of the caregiving system around the child, if we meet that first and fully, well, I imagine my theory is that all would be a lot more well a lot sooner.
It's just speaking, I'm conscious that there's the ongoing murder trial at the moment of the adopted parent. And I don't particularly want to draw you into that because I feel I feel like we haven't even got out of the introduction yet. So I'm doing really badly as an interviewer.
It's all right.
There's life in what we're talking about. It's the stuff of what adoption is, and just reading that account or some of the court reporting, just seeing someone who's been gone way beyond their threshold very quickly with a child and catastrophic results, not an excuse.
Yes, I've been following it gently. I moderate my exposure to certain things. You know, it's in my work, so I have to make sure that I moderate my exposure, and I know my own vulnerabilities, I know my own thresholds. So, and it is the reality. And I suppose that, you know, I have my soapboxes about all of these things, and where, of course, we don't condone anything, there are signs, there are flags, you know, and I say this knowing that most social services are in varying degrees of depletion, whether the social workers themselves are resourced enough, whether they are in shutdown, whether they can cope with what they're exposed to. So you get this systemic burnout, systemic secondary trauma, and in some cases primary trauma. And so when you're working with human beings, one of the things you may have noticed, if you looked on my website, you may or may not have, one of the specific trainings I had was in equine facilitated psychotraumatology, which is such a mouthful.
Rolls off the tongue, that one, doesn't it?
It really does. You can't quite get it on a T-shirt. You need really long arms on your T-shirt. But it's very specifically called that because there are different variations of equine therapy. Some of it is, you know, just experiential equine learning, and sort of skills building and coaching. And this is particularly a model of working with trauma and PTSD and complex PTSD. And so the training is very specific around that. But one of the reasons we work with horses is because they model mammalian limbic resonance and mammalian emotional and or affect, as we've got emotional contagion. So they sort of model either the family constellation or the workplace constellation of one person's physiology or stress levels are, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10, they're an 8, and everyone else is fine, but the person that's at an 8 or feeling quite intense, they walk into the room and suddenly everyone's starting to creep up and everyone's suddenly hitting an 8. Yeah. And the converse is true, and I want to be really mindful that it's not all bad, because someone's sense of joy and resilience and groundedness and regulation can be at an 8, and they can walk into, you know, everything shit hitting the fan type thing. And they can also come in and bring,
and the
whole body, the whole herd can also regulate.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all probably experienced that, haven't you? Where someone comes in and they're perceived to be a really calming influence. They feel like they, or someone's come and they've steadied the ship. And I was thinking about an experience I had, and my one of my children was kind of very, very attached to horses, and we got a horse, as you do. That's so middle class, isn't it? So we got a horse. Mr. La-di-da. One thing, I have no empathy with horses at all. I have a very, if this wasn't a public arena, I would tell you plainly how I'm not impressed by horses at all. However, what I did see was something, I saw some remarkable things happen. One was that I know that if horses are laid down, if you go anywhere, if you like even move towards them, they're on their feet again. They don't like it. And my daughter was sobbing one day, and she was hysterical, and she ran out to the horse, and the horse laid exactly still, and my daughter laid on top of the horse, not the other way around, because that would be a different story.
Yeah.
my daughter laid on top of the horse, and the horse just absolutely absorbed all of this anguish and upset and distress. And we were all like going, this horse isn't, why is this horse? We couldn't fathom it, but it was just, a really odd and peculiar phenomenon. So is that this kind of limbic, this tuning and this kind of mirroring?
Yeah, and, you know, there's so much of it that we can't capture. You know, there's data that we can't capture. We do research around the change process for humans and how it appears that being in relationship with horses can support that. But there's so much we can't capture. But a hypothesis that is quite prevalent amongst the profession is that horses appreciate, in whatever way that is, or are happy to stay near, congruence. So by that I mean that you're thinking, you're feeling, and feeling, you're thinking. You're joined up. You're not masking anything. You're not pretending everything's okay. because sort of energetically to a horse that's essentially nonverbal, they do make sounds, but they're nonverbal and they don't process so much in their prefrontal cortex because they've got much better and wiser things to do with their time, like eating and moving about. But perhaps the sort of hypothesis is that perhaps this discordance that often happens with humans where, for example, we may have some deep-seated grief or fear or something that's just bubbling away under the surface and sometimes quite deeply under the surface. And so we get on with life because that's what you do when you're, you know, I'm the adult, I've got to get on with life. And then you're right, I'm going to go and do this work with this horse, right? I'm going to go in and I'm going to get on and everything's fine. And as soon as you've got this kind of masking and sometimes quite well-meaning, and you know, certainly not doing it to be duplicitous, but just, I'm just going to carry on. And often the horses are either disinterested or will move away or just, you know, there's sort of nothing to see here. And yet when we then take the client or the client group through a process of just coming into a bit more awareness of, you know, how are you, what's really going on, or just having some stillness and taking us out of that busy mind to notice actually, how do I really feel and what's really going on? Or actually, I've got 10 years of frustration wedged somewhere in my system that hasn't had a chance to have a resolution or go through any kind of completion cycle emotionally or psychologically. And actually, when I'm still, I come into contact with that. And often what we see is that when the human is congruent and in sort of presence with their own reality, then the horses seem to enjoy being around us more.
Just but even if we're angry.
Yeah, because anger is truth. And, you know, so it can be, you know, the degree of escalation in how the anger is showing itself, we might say, or you might want to go and have a little walk in the woods first before we come into contact with the horses, just because, you know, there's a welfare issue on the horses there. We're always very protective of the experiences we expose them to. And yet, if that anger is, I don't want to use the word righteous because that's got connotations, but if it's true, anger is information. Anger isn't, we don't believe in emotions as being negative or positive. They're just information. It's telling us that something's not okay. And I suppose where I was sort of going with all of this is when you're in a system with complex individuals with varying degrees of suppressed stuff and stuff that's at the surface, and then you put all of those systems, all of those nervous systems through some kind of conduit or mangle, which could be just be family life or going through the care system or trying to advocate for services and all the stresses. And then you've got the social work nervous system coming into that, and they're managing their caseloads, lack of funding, lack of resources, their own inability, perhaps their own skill set being lacking in some way, and perhaps their own shutdown and not being able to cope. So they've just gone into, I'm just going to function at that sort of masked level. When you put all of those in the room together and they're the decision-making caregiving system, whoops, sorry, banged my microphone, I'm not used to it being there.
It's okay,
when you put all of that then as the sort of the system around the child, you've got a very complex, very dynamic, in inverted commas, a potentially toxic system where no one is thriving and no one is well in terms of just being happy and functioning. And then, of course, we're expecting our children to be able to heal and go through their processes within those systems. So going back to your sort of very first question, I'm a bit like, is it Ronnie Barker or Ronnie Corbett that sits in the chair and wangles on for several hours Ronnie and then Corbett, gets there in the end? Yeah, couldn't remember. Sorry, bless him. But would I like to see a systemic piece around trauma-informed practice, psychological education for everybody involved in those systems, self-responsibility around noticing when we're not okay, and beginning a process and working within when the teams or families that we're in to do restoration and repair? Yes. Could we get the funding to do that? I think it would be wonderful and very, very cost effective, because across the lifespan of everybody involved, in whether it's the employed social workers, the families themselves, or the young person, I think you'd get such great results that actually to the taxpayer bottom line, it would cost a lot less. Mm. Is there the political will or just the awareness? I don't know. Probably not. I think there is on the ground.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Because you think that actually there is a sense of just kicking the problem up the line until it washes into the emergency services. Ultimately, you know, you got the police responding, you've got primary health.
Yeah, and more systems which are full with human beings with nervous systems that reach their thresholds day in and day out. You know, if we keep going up and keep going up and keep going up. But actually, the charity that I work with, so I'm in private practice, but I also work with a charity, and we deliver programs, trauma-informed, trauma-skilled. We use that terminology that they use in Scotland to just delineate that it's not just being aware of the trauma, it's knowing what to do when it shows up in the room. Mm-hmm. And then supporting people to understand, come into understanding themselves so that they can look after themselves in new ways. But so we work with first responders. We work with military veterans. And usually as part of our programs, we also work with a significant partner or family member as part of that as well, so that the learning goes out into the family system and that there's somebody who can be using the same language, can notice when they're making attempts to change behavior and support those changes and embed, but also in recognition that the fact that significant other or family member or all families are also really affected. If you have somebody in your life who has trauma, then the system around that child will be being affected. And of course, in adoption, it's in your face in ways that, you know, most of us can't ignore. Yeah. And yet it is recognized in practice, but it's just this painfully slow process of getting the services to join up. And what I would like to see as part of those services, I would love to see funded by the Adoption Support Fund, is therapy for the parent, carer, parents, SGO, whoever, you know, family members, as part and parcel of any work that's being done with the child. And I do recognize that all of the services that are child-led, child-centered, of course, are so, so important. And yet I think, I don't work with children at all. I work with the adults, and yet I would say that all my work is child-centered, child-led, because my primary passion is to support the environment around them, because when you do that, then the child stands a much better chance of being able to go through their own change process.
And I think that's the point that we connected on. You know, we were part of a Facebook thread, and we sort of got, I think we connected. And to my mind, I think increasingly it's so easy for people to kind of focus in on, I say this in inverted commas, fixing children. But sort of not being able to see or being able to look in the mirror and see that they have been drawn into that system. And to express that in a way that doesn't make them feel as though they're the problem or part, you know, but they are, that they can't sort of, you can't sort of deal with a child in isolation. You can't, and therapy is good and it can be really helpful, but actually it's the other, however many hours a week there is.
Yeah.
Where you are the primary influence, and you can't be a therapist, but we need to support parents. And what is the line then? Are you supporting parents with their own mental health, or are you supporting them to support their children's mental health, or are the two intrinsically linked?
My focus is on their mental health. That is my primary focus. Particularly if usually by the time they've contacted me, they're in some degree of crisis. And that can be different for everybody. So it could just be that they're, you know, just really unhappy, or it could be that, you know, everything's about to break down. And, you know, for me, this, you know, really is no judgment, and it can be very, very painful to first experience what you're experiencing, then acknowledge that you're experiencing it, and then ask for help, or sort of realize that you need to step into a space where you're going to need to expose yourself slightly or a lot. And so I keep quite a container around the fact that I'm only working with that adult's mental health from the point of view of making sure that they feel that they have a safe place to say what they need to say. Because you really need to be able to get to the nub of how their system is expressing their distress. I'm not part of an adoption agency, and so I can't give advice specific really to adoption issues. So, for example, I wouldn't be talking about the child's history or making any forms of suggestion around reunion or birth story or anything like that. But I suppose just through working explicitly with what is happening with that adult and framing it in terms of when we're in this level of distress, it's across three domains. So that's your psychological, cognitive functioning, how you're thinking about things, how you're emotionally feeling, so how you're attributing meaning to what you're thinking and how that makes you feel emotionally, and then how that extreme distress shows up in your body physiologically. And as we talk about that and just talk about how normal it is for the body to start doing these things and the mind to start doing these things and for our emotions to start doing these things when we have been in prolonged chronic stress, then I believe, and the feedback that I've had is that that does start to inform their understanding about what's going on for the child or the young person or young people in their lives. So yes, I am aware that when I work with a primary carer, I am influencing that system, and I try to give them as much information and as much support as possible so that it can have that drip effect. But yes, I don't consciously go in. It's certainly not a parenting course. There's not one single parent or carer that I've worked with who needs a parenting course.
Yeah.
You know, in some cases, it's quite useful to get some of that information. What I do is introduce them to their own nervous system and body and emotional world and say, how can we learn to look after this?
Some people who are maybe listening to this who are not familiar with adoption, contemporary adoption, or not as sort of intimate with it, might be thinking, well, hang on, you're talking about children here, and you're talking about the challenges families are facing causing trauma. You know, you spoke about first responders and sort of you're linking their experience in some way to the experience of adoptive parents. I mean, you're preaching to the choir here, you know, but I'm conscious that, can you make that explicit? Why are people then experiencing trauma because of being a parent?
Because they're a human being, and this is how trauma shows up. It's chemistry.
Right.
It's chemistry and psychology. So prolonged stress and one-off incident stress and complex, you know, timelines of incremental events happening show up in our biology in the same way as it would for somebody served in Afghanistan, or not everybody who is a military veteran ends up with PTSD.
Yeah.
And we understand that some people go into all kinds of lines of work and experience all kinds of difficult things. And it's only quite a small proportion that actually then necessarily sort of, I say suffer, but end up with the outcome that they've experienced or they're experiencing PTSD. And then when you actually look at that, and if you address that and start to look into either, I say treatment in inverted commas as well, so coming alongside that person with those symptoms, what usually happens is you start to find pre-existing vulnerabilities in some way. And some of that doesn't necessarily mean that they've had lots of terrible incidences, but just it could just be a physiological thing, that they just their distress tolerance, their ability to handle cortisol is some way impaired. And when we start looking at our children and we recognize that actually our children's resilience, predisposition to be in a higher cortisol state, perhaps because of their in utero experience, or then compounded by their lived experience in early years development, it's exactly the same chemistry. And then the outcome is then how that then shows up. So all of these symptoms in inverted commas are the behaviors. So for me, when I'm working with either a military veteran or somebody in the ambulance service or a parent who has spent the last 10 years advocating for needs that there has been no response to, false allegation that also sets off the same physiological, psychological responses of threat, perhaps child on parent violence, which doesn't matter if that's a very small person. Often those very small people usually grow into bigger people.
Yeah.
But even if it's at the time you're experiencing, even if they're quite small, there's only so much that the physical body can tolerate before it starts to go through a process of wanting to manage your pain. And I'm sure you know this and many people know. And actually, I have to say, I've not met one single adopter who hasn't done so much research and who doesn't cognitively understand what is going on.
Yeah.
They are the trauma experts. They, you know, and the level of learning when I'm on some forums and someone poses a question and then they get, you know, 150 answers from parents and adopters and carers who've been there and done it. And I'm like, you know, the level of expertise, I'm not an expert in this because I did my training. My training just ticked the boxes and clarified to me that I was right all the time.
Yeah.
I did get some learning. It was fantastic. It's fantastic training that I had. I will say, and it was just, you know, just, I know that.
That's really interesting. Cause you read something and you go, oh, of course, you know, someone brighter than me has written it down in a sentence, like a whole raft of experiences and just been able to kind of summarize them in academia.
Yeah. And I like the science of it. So what I might recognize as a behavior and what you might see as a behavior, when you start to break it down into kind of chemical compounds and you go, okay, we have an adrenalized cortisol driven scenario here. We've got, you know, dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin have gone AWOL. How can we start microdosing? How can we start taking some of the antidote? How can I introduce the antidote? And so,
yeah,
whether I'm working with someone who's had military experience or whether I'm working with a parent care, I'm always working with a mammal. I'm always working with the mammalian system, with a nervous system that operates around, you know, very, very complex ways. A bit like a carburetor, you know, you need a little bit of fuel and a little bit of this, and we're all in different places. And so there's no judgment if one person just happen to be a little less tolerant of cortisol, or, you know, they've managed this adrenalized state for 5 years, but they couldn't do it for 6 years, whereas someone else was able to do it for 10 years, or someone else was able to do it for their entire lifetime for some ameliorating factor that we can't identify. Maybe it was just they had a really lovely rose bush in their garden and it was enough sustenance to help them just ground every day or smell something and remind themselves of something lovely. And they got that daily oxytocin and serotonin and dopamine hit in that way, you know. So what becomes the problem is that we lay moral objectives over the
judgments
top of
on
and judgments
of that,
and expectations. And most of that is based on sort of flawed psychology and just cultural expectations. And it's not based on reality. So when someone is really not okay, rather than starting to go, actually, it'd be really good to go and see if I can get some support. They look around and they see everybody else coping, in inverted commas, or they have a perception on the outside that other people are coping in certain circumstances, or they imagine, well, I'm not a Syrian refugee, or I'm not in the Ukraine right now.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is, and we lay over. And what we don't do is go, my physiology is telling me, without judgment, just as fact, that I've just met a bit of a threshold here. It's not personal. It's not better or worse. It's just shown me that, oh, I've just reached that point and I need to do something. In the same way is usually if, you know, if you twist your ankle, you might notice that, you know, 6 months from now, although it's better, it's still a little bit weak, but you're not like, oh my goodness, that other person broke their leg and, you know, I should just be better. You go, oh, well, I twisted my ankle and that's how it is now. And I need to just take a little bit more care of it. And, and so I'm just very passionate about normalizing reaching a threshold. It's a normal thing and it's actually a safety mechanism. Your body starts to do weird things and our stress levels go up, or we start to show sort of the behaviors of depression, not because there's anything wrong, but because it's our body's fantastic way of saying, hey, now's the time, input please.
Little flag saying, yeah, do something different, step away, or like you say,
just stand still for a second. Yeah
And so do you see, because one of the things that I am conscious of, and it's probably where there is a really clear parallel, is that if you're a police officer, you remain a police officer. And again, this is one of the issues that really piqued my interest, this idea that often as a social worker, I'm going into a situation where the trauma may be historic, but it's also very, or the adversity is historic, but it's also very present. And helping people to walk out of that, you know, that their experience of trauma and adversity whilst in trauma and adversity, is that seems to be missing. It kind of dawned on me when we had that conversation that actually that's just a gap where we're sort of, often trauma recovery is about something that happened in the past, not for people like parents who often it may not change. It may remain.
Yeah, they're still in it. Well, I mean, I can tell you from my work and the way that I was trained and prepared, is that actually there's an obligation to keep the person safe. And when you are in a situation that is current and you are surviving, you are, mm-hmm. you know, it's in real time and you are still in survival, it's essential that anything that you are doing is done with care. Any therapeutic or supportive work is done with care. And actually at that point, we wouldn't unpack the what is going on and the historical reasons behind, because however we are surviving, however we are somehow surviving, and it may not feel like we're surviving, certainly not thriving, but to unpack when you're in it can take away crucial defenses. I'll give you an example because I don't want to get to, but you know, hypervigilance, for example. So sometimes when we're in highly stressed, chronic situations, we can have hypervigilance. And so that can look like, you know, being very, very alert all the time, easily startled. And thinking about your hearing as well, our hearing becomes more sensitive, so we're able to hear. And this comes down to just how we've formed as mammals, how we've evolved as mammals. And I know anybody listening, lots of people listening will know all about this. But, you know, we've evolved to survive. That is our primary function. Our psychology and our emotions and our physiology is about survival. It's not about thriving, actually. It's about remembering the difficult things so that we never do them again, or that we aren't affected by painful circumstances. And the place in the brain that we experience emotional pain is exactly the same as physical pain. So psychologically, we can become hypervigilant to mood behaviors of others.
Yeah.
The very, or, you know, imperceptible visually, either through hearing or through sight, but just almost the kinetic information before an escalation happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're talking about the micro movements, the involuntary, micro body movements. So we can be perceiving things that are not visible to other people.
Yeah.
And this is part of that hypervigilant state that we recognize in our children, but that also we can start to recognize in ourselves. And perhaps we might have had that from our own previous history as well, in some way it's triggered. So my work wouldn't be to reduce that, because in some way that's somehow keeping everybody safe. Now, whether that means that they're having a great time, no, probably not having a great time. Keeping you alive is a kind of the cutoff, really, for our deeper psychological defense system. So to go and unpack that when you are in it needs to be done very, very cautiously. And I would start to work around skills building. And I hate that term because it sounds like it's about parenting. I would be skills building around noticing escalation, noticing our own escalation, noticing the very small ways that we can start to very subtly interrupt our own response to the escalation that's in the room, whilst never ignoring very real threat. Yeah. So it's a bit of a dance. It's a bit of a dance. And fundamentally, it is always going to land at the feet of the parent carer to be, where possible, the person that starts to drip feed a sense of either just containment or de-escalation, usually. Now, sometimes the children and young people get some of that learning themselves, and they can start to do their own interruption, and they can start to be the thing that, you know, to be that sort of benevolent spanner in the works. It's always what we're looking for. But usually it needs to be the parent carer. So I suppose at that stage where we might not go into really processing what's happened or the big events that have happened, you know, the number of terrifying events they've maybe been exposed to in some way, we might not unpick those things. We might start to go, and how can we look after your nervous system right in this moment? And how, you know, how might stepping half a meter to the side and taking one deep breath in and out, could that in some way start to influence your nervous system? And could that nervous system start to influence the nervous systems of the people in the room in some way? And you're starting to work at a deep subcortical level that is purely around mammalian escalation and de-escalation. And the reason that I know that this exists and works is because we see it in the horses.
Yeah. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. And I have to say, you've got an incredibly soothing tone.
Oh, I
just try to be...
It's because it's quarter to nine and I'm tired. I was far more lively. Sounded like Basil Brush at 9 o'clock this morning.
You slowly get down to a kind of more measured tone by tea time. I think this is just absolutely fascinating. I think we've probably run out of time, though, which is really frustrating. But I'm interested to know.
No problem.
I could talk to you for hours. One thing you said there, which really, really struck a bell with me, was we as a family, we sort of got to a point where we were hyper, hyper vigilant. And I don't think we realized we were. And we saw threat coming like 20 minutes out. You know, we saw, and these micro things that you know, micro expressions and micro hints, cues, tells, whatever. And it was odd because other people would come and go, you're just being a over-anxious parent. But then I had other friends who were adoptive parents, and they could see it. They go, oh yeah. This is coming. And it was really odd that there was some people who'd lived it and kind of were going, I see exactly what you're saying, that there's this kind of, so that was fascinating. But can you tell me a bit more about how, kind of to wrap it up really, is tell me a bit more about Wild Ways, about the work you do and how people can, is there a way, because there's probably people listening going to go, all right, I need to speak to this woman right now. Yeah, where's the phone? Is that possible? Yeah. Is there a way people can maybe connect into you with the work that you do?
Yeah, definitely. So obviously I'm in private practice, and that is Wild Ways Therapy. So you could look at my website, that's wildwaystherapy.co.uk. And I'm really excited because a few years ago I started to work with a charity called the Dare to Live Trust. And I'm now one of their program co-directors. And predominantly they were working with military veterans, as I said, first responders. But all the way through, I just kept going, well, it's trauma, it's mammalian trauma. Let's just get this human business out of the way. This is mammalian trauma, and I know a huge population that is underserved. And in particular, I know a huge population that is underserved because the focus is usually on the child or the children or young people. And yet the biggest resource we have in the world of adoption and fostering are the adults that go in and say, I want to do this. I want to try. I'm in. They're our greatest resource. Yeah. They are holding the most pivotal influence in the whole dynamic. And so for the last 3 years, I've been waving the flag at the Dare to Live Trust that as soon as we've got some time and as soon as we can make some, please, we need to run an adopters program. It's my passion. Right. And as it happens, other faculty members and facilitators who work with the Dare to Live Trust, we also have an adult adoptee, as it happens, is one of my colleagues. We also have a foster carer who's one of my colleagues. And between all of us, we also have a speech and language therapist who's also a trauma therapist. We've got a lot of knowledge of neurodivergence, and also I have a lot of knowledge of FASD. So I was just like, we are a great team and we need to be taking this program out. So the Dare to Live Trust, you can find out about them through Dare to Live, Dare to, as in T-O, daretolive.org.uk. And just watch the space. It's coming. It's not here yet. We're putting the fund, we've just put a funding bid in, and we're going to start to work regionally. So I'm based in the Southeast. But we will be taking that on the road because we've got other centres and other people who've trained with us. So we'll be working our way around the country. Excellent. And just passing on the knowledge that we know. And we want to be a resource for all the incredible parents and carers and adopters and families who are doing just the greatest job.
I mean, that's fantastic. And I think that we'd love, you know, any news you've got, please share it with
Lovely.
Us and we'll make
yeah.
sure we push it
yeah.
out and we'll get, you know, get that to as many people as possible. Mary Joy, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it on a, you know, Wednesday night when you're probably ready to be feet up watching EastEnders or whatever.
No problem. It's a real joy to talk about it, and I genuinely could probably do at least 10 episodes because it's my passion. But yeah, happy to answer anybody's questions at any point if they want to ping it through your Facebook page or anything like that. Happy to answer questions, and if anybody wants to reach out, that's fine.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. There's a few final comments. Is Karen Anne on Twitter, on Facebook, has said, this is amazing. My experience isn't around adoption, but having a father in the Navy, and I can relate to this and how it impacted on one of my children who struggled. Another one saying, great conversation. Thank you. Yeah, quite a lot of comments there. Really, people really appreciate listening to you. So thank you very much, Mary Joy.
Do you know what? I'm going to just say one last thing. However you're feeling, it's completely normal. You're not going mad, and there is nothing wrong with you at all. It is your nervous system reacting appropriately to prolonged stress. So it can get better.
That is a great ending. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.